I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. I'm Raven Dodd, and I'll be your worship associate this morning. Our minister, Reverend Lisa Day, will be returning to the pulpit in August, and our choir will return in September. Our speaker this morning is Michael Granato. Michael was a PhD candidate in philosophy at Staffordshire University and an educator. His academic research focuses on the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard's philosophy of time and the reception of relativity theory in the early 20th century France. Now entering his 12th year as an educator, Michael currently teaches high school social studies at Prisma Schools and philosophy at Georgia Southern University. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be, and wherever you are on your journey. With the lighting of our chalice, the symbol of Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. These words are by Sean Gibson. We light our chalice in the spirit of transformation. Nothing stays the same. Everything is moving, shifting, changing. Guide us all to a wild and holy vision of our shared humanity.
The following is a poem by Edna Vincent Millay, Time Does Not Bring Relief. Time does not bring relief. You all have lied. Who told me that time would ease my pain? I miss him in the weeping of the rain. I want him at the shrinking of the tide. The old snows melt from every mountainside, and last year's leaves are smoke in every lane. But last year's bitter loving must remain. Heaped on my heart and my old thoughts abide. There are 100 places where I fear to go, so with the memory of him they brim. And entering with some relief some quiet place where never fell his foot or shone his face, I say, there is no memory of him here, and so stand stricken, so remembering him. The first reading is going to be from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, verses 28 through 32. This is Arjuna speaking. You lap the worlds into your burning mouths and swallow them up, filled with your terrible radiance, O Vishnu. The whole of creation burst into flames. Tell me who you are, O Lord of terrible form. I bow before you. Have mercy. I want to know who you are, you who existed before all creation. Your nature and workings confound me. Lord Krishna responded, Time I am, the destroyer of all. I've come to consume the world. Even without your participation, all the warriors gathered here will die. Second reading is from Gaston Bachelard's Intuition of the Instant. It's the opening paragraph of the book. The decisive metaphysical proposition in Rompel's book is this: time has but one reality, the instant. Otherwise put, time is a reality confined to the instant and suspended between two voids. Although time will no doubt be reborn, it must first die. It cannot transport its being from one instant to another in order to forge duration. The instant is already solitude. It is a solitude in the barest metaphysical value. Yet an even more poignant solitude confirms the tragic solitude of the instant. Through a sort of creative violence, time, limited to the instant, isolates us not only from others, but even from ourselves, since it breaks with our most cherished past. First and foremost, thank you all for having me. If you're visiting today, I apologize in advance that you have to hear some strange person ramble about philosophy. But thank you for being here. Reverend Lisa will be back shortly. She's a much better speaker and presenter than me. So my name is Michael Granato. A few things about me real quick. I am a high school history teacher, which means two things. First and foremost, if you have questions about anything that I say, be more than happy to answer those in the reception hall after the service. And secondly, if you fiddle around on your phone, fall asleep, play video games while I'm talking, I won't take offense to it. I'm going to tell you a little bit, and also thank you to the UU staff for accommodating. I tend to move around a lot. I know that could be a little difficult, especially if we got the cameras and the sound system. So thank you all for accommodating my anxiety, I guess. So a little bit about me. Oh, and I forgot, a disclaimer. I'm going to be talking about philosophy, yes, but this is philosophy that touches upon some very serious things, such as questions concerning the meaning of life. But I want to remind everybody, philosophy is not therapy. If you're having serious issues with these questions, please consult, first and foremost, a mental health professional. Do not consult a philosopher, okay, or a teacher. We won't be able to help you, okay? All right. So another question I won't answer is how long I've been working on my thesis. But this is who I've been working on, is the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard there in the center. To understand Bachelard, you really have to understand a lot of the things that were happening in early 20th century France and in the history of science. And of course, the most groundbreaking thing that happened in the 20th century, without a doubt, is Einstein's theory of relativity, which had a lot of different sorts of responses to it, especially in France. There's a very heated debate that happens between Henri Bergson, another French philosopher, and Albert Einstein, of course, who needs no introduction. But to understand, Bachelard's writing on the heels of this conversation that's happening. And in order to understand what Bachelard is talking about, you have to understand this historical component. So Henri Bergson, by the time of the 20th century, was probably the most famous philosopher in France. He had published two major works in the tail end of the 19th century, Time and Free Will and Creative Evolution, and was kind of at the height of his popularity. Einstein really gets his start in the early 20th century. 1905 is what's known as Einstein's miracle year. He publishes four revolutionary papers in physics that radically alters the course of physics. And this is what propels Einstein's scientific career. It's this third paper on the electrodynamics of moving bodies that is going to concern us most today. I'm not going to go into it, don't worry. You can read the paper if you like to torture yourself. Einstein's a pretty good writer, just these are technical papers, right? In the electrodynamics of moving bodies, Einstein challenges one of the most fundamental concepts in classical physics. So classical physics is the physics that was developed by Isaac Newton and which held sway over the physics community for about 250 years. And one of the fundamental ideas of Newton's physics are notions of absolute time and space. So if you want to think of this room that you're in here now as the Newtonian universe, Time and space would be the foundations of this building. You can't see it, you can't touch it, but you know it's there because the building's still standing. Okay? But under the Newtonian system, time and space didn't interact with reality. It was a mathematical formula that laid the foundation for Newtonian physics. With Einstein, he's going to flip that. Einstein's going to bring time and space into the physical universe, and therefore time and space are able to be influenced by aspects of the physical universe, specifically mass and the speed of light. But I'm not going into that because I'm a philosopher, not a scientist. Okay? But what this meant, what this means for us, is that the passage of time is variable. It changes according to the relative velocity of two observers. So one observer here on Earth, one observer on Mars, they're going to have two different experiences of the passage of time, which is crazy. Wrap your head around that, okay? Einstein publishes these papers in 1905. He gets pretty well known in Germany. Then this little thing called the First World War happens. World War I has obviously a humongous impact, not just on the world and politics and everything else that's happening, but also in the development of the scientific community. It splits apart the scientific community. There's a lot of really interesting but horrible history behind that, but World War I essentially puts a halt to science and everything else, but science also. So it's not really until after the First World War that Einstein comes back in the picture. He's awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1921, actually for the first paper on the electromagnetic effect. The reason why he's not giving the Nobel Prize for relativity is because of Bergson. It's one of the reasons why the committee cited. Bergson argued that Einstein's theory of relativity was not a scientific idea, but a philosophical one, and that the reason for this is because if you read these papers, it's just a bunch of mathematical formulas, okay? One of the things that we're often mistaken about by science is that science proceeds from observation and from experiment. This is what we're taught. The scientific process, the scientific method from a young age. There's no experimentation, there's no observation in Einstein's early papers. It's just mathematical formula. So this is the reason why Einstein was not awarded the Nobel Prize for his theory of relativity. After he's awarded the Nobel Prize in an attempt to bring back the scientific community, Einstein goes on this world tour. And one of his first stops is Paris, France. He's invited there by the Society of French Philosophy. And it's while there that he'll meet Bergson face to face for the first time. He knew about Bergson. Bergson prevented him from getting the Nobel Prize, but they had never actually met. Einstein goes to Paris. He gives his spiel about relativity. After he gives his speech, Bergson is invited up to remark, because everybody loves a little drama. And this is what Bergson had to say. Common sense believes in a single time, the same for all beings and all things. Where does this belief come from? Each of us feels that we endure. This duration is the very flow, continuous and undivided, of our inner life. So, to be clear, Bergson's not objecting to any of the scientific ideas that are presented by Einstein. Bergson's objecting to Einstein's epistemology. In philosophy, epistemology is the study of knowledge. How do we know what we know? What Bergson's objecting to is where Einstein's claiming to get knowledge of time from. For Bergson, and for most people who have ever existed, most philosophers who have ever existed, how do you know about time? If I were to walk around and ask each of you, where does your sense of time come from? Well, if you're listening to me now and you can understand me, you've been alive for a short period of time, and your knowledge of time comes from your direct experience. You've lived it.
This is what Bergson means by intuition. Our sense of time comes from our direct experience of time. And what Bergson's objecting to is Einstein saying something different. Einstein's response to Bergson, "There is no time of the philosopher." All right, well, that's all I got for today. I guess we can pack it up. That's all there is to say. Just kidding. My wife, Summer, doesn't think that joke's funny, but I think it's funny. There is no time of the philosopher. Okay. There's only a psychological time different from the time of physicist. Now, what Einstein's drawing attention to, there's a really interesting period in the history of psychology. Psychology in France hadn't really become its own discipline yet. And so Einstein's drawing attention to the fact, well, there may be something psychologically speaking to time, but real time is what's defined by physics. And, you know, that's highly debatable, but, you know, different story for a different day. What Bergson is calling our attention to, and the reason why this debate is so important, oftentimes when I teach introduction to philosophy, I like to ask my students what they think philosophy is. What does philosophy do? What do we study? Why do they have to take this class? And one of the most common responses that I get is philosophy is just a bunch of unanswerable questions asked by a lot of old men a really long time ago. It's not wrong, but I want to change that perception. There's also new unanswerable questions that philosophy presents to us. And one of these questions is time. One of the fundamental problems of today is that the description of time given to us by physics does not correspond to our experience of time. That's really weird. Really weird. This is what Paul Davis has to say in his article, That Mysterious Flow. Nothing in known physics corresponds to the passage of time. Nothing. Indeed, physicists insist that time doesn't flow at all. It merely is. Now, I would love for time not to pass. I'm approaching the big 4-0. I would like to not hit that milestone. But our experience of time is that it does pass. So how do we make sense of that? I don't have a great answer for you. I'm not going to give an answer to you. But show must go on. So Bachelard thinks that this presents not just a unique epistemological problem, but also a more metaphysical problem. So Bachelard writes about relativity in his first book, The Inductive Value of Relativity. And again, from a knowledge perspective, from an epistemological perspective, this is what he has to say about relativity as a theory. We can say that by examining the phenomenon on a completely new theoretical level, relativity really invents the experience. That's our experience of time. That it creates its experience. So there's a sort of classic question in the philosophy of science. What exactly is philosophy telling us about? It's telling us about nature and that we experience nature directly with our senses. But Bachelard's saying with relativity, it's not really what we get. We get a description, a mathematical description of nature that actually contradicts our experience. Relativity creates its experience. Okay, well, why does any of this matter on a more existential level? Bachelard says it matters because it's not that there's an inherent contradiction between our experience of time and relativity, but that relativity reveals something very fundamental about our experience of time that helps us to answer questions that relates to meaning in life. Bachelard says that time is confined to the instant that we've experienced the past, and so it might be helpful or confusing to think of our past self as one observer in the Einsteinian universe and our present self as a different observer in the Einsteinian universe. And what does that mean? That our experience of time, that my experience of time now is going to be different from my experience of time in the past. It's going to have two different feelings, two different meanings, which allows for the possibility of creation, the possibility of freedom, and perhaps most importantly, the possibility for us to break with our past. Duration is formed. It's not necessarily grounded on a uniform, regular time. So in philosophy, one of the big questions, of course, that we deal with is, what is the meaning of life? It's one of those big, unanswerable questions. Well, we like to make this distinction between meaning of and meaning in, which got deleted from this PowerPoint. That's okay. Meaning of versus in. Meaning of life is big picture. What meaning does the universe give us to life as a whole, to humanity's existence as a whole, versus meaning in? What is the meaning of my life? Bachelard thinks that time, the view of time given by relativity, is going to give us an answer to meaning in. Because here's another weird thing. If I were to ask you all, what is the meaning of your life, what would be the answer that you would give me? Most of you would give me some form of life narrative that makes sense of what has happened to you over the course of your life. All narratives, all personal narratives, presuppose an idea of time. They're all based on an idea of time. And Bachelard says that there have traditionally been two major ideas about the time of our lives. The first idea is that time is fixed, that the past is past, there's nothing we can do about it, we're in the present moment, and we're being, in a sense, pushed, propelled towards the future. But the time that relativity gives us, according to Bachelard, is what? Different times for different observers. Which means that we are not necessarily propelled towards the future, and which means, oddly enough, that the past is not really past. That it's malleable, that we can change our relationship to the past. All right, so one of the things that, I'll get to RuPaul here in a second. One of the things that Bachelard is known for is his incorporation of French philosophy and poetry and art into his philosophical writing. So in that spirit, I'm going to compare and contrast one of the fundamental points from Bachelard with a form of art that I really appreciate, which is drag. And one of the things that drag does is it challenges our traditional conceptions of things like gender roles and, for example, how men and women ought to look, what they should look like. And it teaches us that those perceptions are culturally based, determined, given to us by our society, but they're not built in nature. Right? They're social constructs. And what this means for a philosopher like RuPaul, we're all born naked and the rest is drag, that we get to invent that identity, that it's largely up to us to create that identity, and we can change that identity over the course of our life if we want. And Bachelard's basically saying the same thing about your personal narrative, that there's a constructive element to it, that we can pivot, that we can change. But the past presents to us a problem for meaning. There's a philosopher named Marilyn McCourt Adams who, another unanswerable question in philosophy is the question of the problem of evil, the meaning of evil and suffering in the life of the individual. Marilyn McCourt Adams says that the experience of horrendous evils, numerous examples here, the experience of horrendous evils, things such as violence, things such as war, genocide, personal loss, the loss of parents, the loss of a child, that all of these things threaten to engulf meaning in our life. They are life defeaters in the sense that they can take away, if philosophy is able to give us an answer to life, and if philosophy is able to say that life does have meaning, then this also means that there are some cases in which life does not have meaning. And Adams identifies these cases as the experience of horrendous evils. So what do we do about these evils? Bachelard says that, interestingly enough, relativity allows us to hold these evils in connection with the present in order for us to, it's kind of like a gestalt shift in psychology, to change our perspective about our interpretation of our past. For the person who continues to love, I should have also added that grief is a reoccurring theme throughout Bachelard's writing, because this mattered to Bachelard not just in an intellectual level, but also in a personal level. He lost his wife very early on in his life, and so it kind of happens again and again throughout his writing that we see this. For the person who continues to love, a lost love is both present and past. Present for the faithful heart, past for the unhappy heart. Thus, for the heart capable of accepting suffering and fond recollection at the same time, a lost love is both pain and solace. Sorry, that's cut off there. All right. So I want to end here with a quote by the French poet. I'll pause here. Jean Lescure, who's writing about Bachelard. And Lescure identifies one of the major takeaway points from Bachelard's philosophy is this ability for us to break with our past. We're not beholden to those past experiences. And this is what Lescure has to say. The paths towards purification presuppose the possibility of reiterated births. They call for the instant to shatter temporal fate, for discontinuity to authorize surprising events. If the cruelest mourning is the consciousness of a future betrayed, the obstinate evidence of time as purveyor of wonder, surprise, and novelty is indeed associated with this initial revelation of suffering, with this eruption of the plundering instant. That which thrust me into the jaws of death is also that which offers me a chance to be reborn. For never, not for a single moment, are we the sum of our past. Each instant discovered is that which grants a new sense at every instant to the senseless history we have lived thus far. It is what grants our efforts some meaning we need in order to seize the soul that shall be ours. A modicum of happiness is possible in this world, even when its presence is realized through the absence forever thrust upon us. The purest happiness, the one we have lost. Thank you.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.